recently at a press briefing in New Haven, Connecticut. These K2 victims have been living with this truth inside their bodies for over 20 years, and many died as that toxic truth took them to their early graves. Yet we still do not know exactly what lurked in the air and water and the earth at K2. We do not know because the government refuses to release the records of the toxins found at K2. Brooks' husband, U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Timothy Brooks, died of a brain tumor at the age of 36 in 2004, less than 3 years after being stationed at K2. A preliminary study by the U.S. Army found in 2015 that K2 veterans were 5 times more likely than other troops to develop cancer. The contaminants allegedly included pools of black goo that caused troops to pass out. A U.S. Department of Defense spokesperson, contacted by ABC News, declined to comment on the lawsuit. The Pentagon has claimed it's doing a more in-depth investigation because the 2015 study was too limited to show a definitive link between K2 and serious illnesses. U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal, a Connecticut Democrat who joined the plaintiff groups, at a recent press conference said the lawsuit shows the government's neglect and disregard for veterans. He added that the list of hazardous materials to which troops were exposed at K2 is staggering and the neglect is stunning. The lawsuit marks just the latest controversy over exposure of U.S. service members to carcinogens and other toxins. The Pentagon acknowledged last month that U.S. military pilots and ground crew members have contracted various types of cancer at abnormally high rates. In February, the U.S. Air Force expanded its investigation of cancer risks for troops stationed at the country's intercontinental ballistic missile ICBM bases. Veterans have claimed high rates of cancer, including non-Hodgkin lymphoma, among people who worked at ICBM bases. According to Wall Street Journal, a Pentagon study finds higher cancer risks among military pilots and ground crews. Military pilots and ground crews have fuel and maintain military aircraft are at higher risk for certain types of cancer than the general U.S. population, according to a study from the U.S. Department of Defense. The data was collected during a year-long study of nearly 900,000 members who either flew or serviced military aircraft from 1992 to 2017, the Pentagon said.
Palestine and international tournaments. Sports in Palestine faces a lot of obstacles that disturb the true essence of what sport is about. Under Israeli occupation for more than half a century, the industry of sport suffers greatly, just as the Palestinians themselves suffer daily.
We participated in several championships, including the Batna International Championship in Algeria. We also participated in the Arabic Championship and took 5th place. However, Palestine was deprived from participating in many external championships due to the Israeli siege that has been imposed for the past decade. In those 10 years, time goes by, along with the age of players, which means the end of their sporting career.
The Israeli occupation does not like to see Palestinian sports that represent the Palestinians as a civilian nation to the world with the ability to compete with other teams. The Palestinian athletes do not have immunity at all. Palestinian sports in general is not immune, whether in times of war or without war. You may find the Israeli warplanes shelling a sports club or stadium, arresting a player, or preventing a team from participating abroad.
And now, the national anthem of Palestine.
Sports for Palestinians could perhaps play a role in international forums. But the Israeli occupation does not want any positive attention to shine on the occupied territory, and so it oppresses sports development as a strategy to keep the international community away from the occupation's repressive activities.
For your information, in some championships, Israel imposed on the host nation not to raise any country's flag so that Palestine's flag would not be raised. However, in the last championship held in Australia, Israel was not able to dictate its preferences. So Palestine's flag was raised and the Palestinian anthem was played when the Palestinian team marched out on the grounds. This is considered an achievement for us.
Having Palestine's flag raised in the Asian Championships for the first time was a huge achievement. However, raising our flag in Australia is our biggest achievement, especially as we know Australia voted against Palestine 2 weeks before at the UN Assembly. Our nation has the right to have a state and live in peace. We deserve to live. Today we are among 16 Asian countries. Although our country is under siege and the most basic necessities do not exist, our national team is here today, among the teams of great countries like Japan, Iran, Australia, Korea, and others. When hearing the national anthem here in this stadium with the players and technical team, in which I am a member, with the rest of the Arab, Palestinian, and Asian audience which supported our team to the finals, it gives you an indescribable feeling. This feeling comes because you're one of the soldiers who participated in raising the flag of your country in the international arena.
The Palestinian team qualified to the finals in the Asian Cup for the first time in history. The Asian Cup started in the 1960s. The Israeli occupation used to participate among other countries under the name of the State of Israel as if Palestine did not exist. In 1970, a group of noble and honest Arabs expelled Israel from the Asian Football Confederation and replaced them with Palestine as a member. We regained our right to membership of the International Football Federation, in which we can participate in the World Cup. The occupation knows that sports creates a good image toward the Palestinian people, so it wants to sabotage it, destroy it, and hide it from the world. It wants to present the Palestinians to the world as terrorists.
For every athlete in Palestine, there is a sad tale of suppressed opportunity under the Israeli occupation, which deliberately puts obstacles before the Palestinian sporting industry to keep it behind closed doors.
One of the circumstances that helped me play football was living near Rafah Services Club and the UNRWA Club. I was able to get into the national junior team, the national youth team, then the Olympic team, and finally the national team. I received the best junior player title in the Palestinian League for the year 2005 to 2006. On July the 22nd, 2009, I was supposed to travel to the West Bank to join Balata Youth Center Club as a professional player at the boot camp of the national team in Al Farah. However, some other players and I were stopped, and I was arrested. I was the only one among them to be arrested, and without reason.
I was assigned to form the Palestinian Federation for Self-Defense Games, sponsored by the Paralympics Committee. This committee is specialized in training special needs athletes in order that they may participate in international championships and the Olympics. We received an invitation from the MRT Ahli Club to participate in the Dubai International Championship of 2016. We participated with a team of six players, one able female, an able male, and four visually impaired athletes. Our team competed strongly in this championship, and for the first time in Arab and Palestinian team, won third position and received a bronze medal. It feels great to raise the Palestinian flag and play the Palestine national anthem at such a championship. Upon our team's return back home, I was arrested by the Israeli police and detained for 5 hours, and the blind players were also held. My team insisted on not leaving without me. How could they leave when they have no one to guide them back home?
It's no coincidence that the arrest of Palestinian athletes has pushed a number of prisoners from the sports sector to more than 70. This number refers to the expansion of deliberate targeting of promising sports champions by the occupation.
I was detained without charge for no other reason than for being a Palestinian athlete representing my country. I spent 3 years in the Israeli prisons. During my sentence period, I was interrogated from time to time and manipulated to try to make me confess to anything. But in the end, they had to let me go. It shows to what extent the Israeli intelligence had nothing on me. They wanted to prove that they did not just arrest a Palestinian athlete, but a terrorist from their view. They could not prove anything, so they released me after 3 years. I was released, but with many health problems, because I had gone on a hunger strike for 96 days. These problems prevented me from continuing my football career. I do not wish for any athlete to experience the same situation I faced.
Upon our arrival to the Erez, Beit Hanun checkpoint, we were supposed to have a press conference with a number of international journals and agencies. But to our surprise, I was arrested and the blind boys were held and pushed outside. I was held for 26 days in the interrogation cells at Ashkelon prison. They accused me of training terrorists. I responded, "If you say that these blind boys are terrorists, I wonder how you can call them terrorists." It was bizarre that the interrogator was watching some reports on YouTube about the team, and he knew that I was training these blind boys. They presented me with a number of trials, 5 trials consecutively. Each trial extended my arrest period. I was released after the last trial, innocent of all charges. I believe that the whole thing was for the purpose of disruption and killing of our happiness, so that the people in Gaza would not feel the joy of our success.
The case of Hassan al-Rai is not the first one. We have more than 70 to 80 cases like his. There is the case of Sami Ad-Daur, who was arrested simply for being a national team player, along with Fadi al-Sharif. Ayman al-Nafadi received a medical transfer to have a crucial ligament operation. After his operation, he returned back to Gaza and was immediately arrested with his fresh injury. Beit Hanun Eretz checkpoint has become a daily arrest and interrogation point. Its purpose is to insult people. How could a country that presents itself as being a democratic state grant an entrance visa to someone and then arrest them?
Israeli violations were not limited to false arrests. They adhered to discriminatory policies of not issuing travel permits for players to participate in both domestic and international championships.
Athletics games are competitive. It requires capabilities. To become international, you need tremendous capabilities. It requires the potentials of countries, not individuals. Because of the siege on our country and the closure of the Rafah border crossing for the past 2 years now, Palestinian runner Inas was not able to travel to participate in a championship in the UAE. She was not given a pass to travel across Eretz Point. Furthermore, she was supposed to participate in the Beit Lehem 10-kilometer marathon, but she did not get a checkpoint pass for that either.
We exercised hard to have our names included in the Bethlehem Championship, but because of not receiving a checkpoint pass, I was deprived from participating. I trained intensely for the 10-kilometer race for 2 months prior to the race, even though I knew I had no permission to pass. We practiced hard, and I think maybe we could have won first place in that competition.
As a trainer for the national team, I suffered a lot moving between the governorates to reach Ramallah to be with the Palestine national team. It was hard for the players I chose from the clubs in Gaza to reach the northern governorates, which affected the competitive level of the national team. It is hugely suffering for the athletes inside Palestine.
We could not get the majority of our players to the northern governorates because of the delay in getting checkpoint passes. On one hand, because these games have specific dates, and on the other hand, the permissions to pass were either denied or given after the expiration of the specific date of the games, so Gazan athletes did not participate in these games.
Palestine participated in the 2010 World Cup playoffs. According to the draw, we were supposed to face the team of Malaysia. As we do not have a home ground, we used to play our games outside Palestine. We were matched up with Malaysia in an away game. We were supposed to meet the team in Malaysia, but 3 days before the match, the Israeli occupation prevented the Palestinian team from leaving. This injustice was not confined to the Israeli occupation. FIFA too was unjust towards us when it issued a statement in which the Palestinian team was condemned for not participating.
Practically every country in the world has a unified football league, with the exception of Palestine, which is forcibly deprived of that right. So the Palestinian Football Union seeks to at least unite the West Bank and Gaza Strip leagues to try to address Israeli measures that impose separation between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
The occupation is what divides the Palestinian territories into smaller parts. I'm referring to the 1948 Palestinian territories. There are the northern governorates of the West Bank and the southern governorates of the Gaza Strip. We try as much as possible to unite these communities by holding local competitions with the Palestinian clubs in the governorates of our land.
We have a diaspora league, the West Bank League, and the Gaza League. The teams in Gaza are not permitted to meet the teams of the West Bank, nor the diaspora. I mean, Barcelona and Real Madrid can move throughout Spain, but in Gaza, its teams play only each other, and the teams within the West Bank play each other. So there is one champion in Gaza and one champion in the West Bank. We've been appealing to the world to pressure the occupation to allow our teams access across checkpoints. This appeal is 20 years old now. We've had 20 years of league championships in Gaza, which have all been kept separate from the West Bank championships.
When the Palestinian National Authority took over, there were many attempts to have one unified league between the West Bank and Gaza. However, the obstacle of not having to pass the district prevented players from coming together. This also resulted in poor communications between the athletes and teams from each area, so we had to come up with the compromise of having two leagues. One league includes the clubs of Gaza, the other includes the clubs of the West Bank. I hope one day the winners of the two districts can play each other.
For a quarter of a century, we've appealed, and I myself appealed to football officials associated with FIFA, which is to have one unified Palestinian league. We want a league similar to that of the USA, Russia, Britain, Spain, France, Germany, and all countries around the world. We want to establish a unified league that unites the West Bank and Gaza, but Israel stands against this.
Setting a precedent, the Palestinian Football Union, in 2015, held a match between trophy champions of the West Bank and Gaza, despite all that was done by the occupation to prevent any such meeting.
In 2015, the winners of the Cup of Gaza, for the first time in 15 years, met up with the winners of the West Bank Cup. They met despite the will of the occupation because of the intervention of FIFA. The away game was held in Gaza, while the home game was held in the West Bank, and then we pronounced the outright winner.
The union decided to hold a match between the champions of the northern governorates and southern governorates so as to decide a unified champion that would represent Palestine in the Asian Games. The match was between the Shujaya Union Club, representing Gaza governorates, and Al Khalil Ahli Club, representing the West Bank. The Al Khalil Ahli Club won the championship.
We were excited, but Israel obstructed the event by arresting a number of players, and the Shabak Israeli Security Agency interrogated them for several hours. In addition to this, many players were refused a checkpoint pass. If it was not for the interference of FIFA and other countries, this sporting event would have not been held.
The escalation of violations by the occupying forces against Palestinian sports and athletes did not stop at international norms. Its momentum increased in the wars waged by the occupation on Gaza, the most violent of which occurred in the summer of 2014.
Palestine Stadium was shelled with a dozen bombs, each weighing about a ton. The stadium was completely destroyed. Not only the stands, but the whole field was unplayable. The Rafah Municipal Stadium was also shelled in 2008. This city has champion teams, but we've been unable to rebuild the stadium until now. Till now, I find it difficult as an athlete, a Palestinian, or even a follower of sports and current affairs to understand why the occupation would bombard playgrounds and sports clubs. We don't know the reason except to think that the occupation does not want to see any young Palestinian, especially athletes, to achieve greatness in sport or for them to play other Arab teams or internationally.
Rafah Stadium was one of the targets of Israel's military complex. We don't know why. It is just a stadium like any other around the world. Palestinian youth play in this stadium. It was, however, shelled with more than just one bomb by an F-16 warplane. The building and the grounds were completely destroyed. Now it is a playground without any stands. Of course, the field is not suitable to play on, but it is the only one that exists. Fragments of steel and rock can be still seen there. Many players stayed away from the stadium because of the bombardment.
Clubs were bombed, centers were bombed. More than 30 sports locations were bombed during the aggression on Gaza. There are no more than 5 stadiums, so the agenda of the General Federation of Football was affected dramatically. The capacity of other stadiums is limited, so by shelling these stadiums, from the Israeli perspective, it totally disrupts Palestinian sports.
The recent war on Gaza by the occupation's military exceeded every human standard and killed more than 27 Palestinian athletes. They joined the long list of victims who were athletes and martyred.
In the past 20 years, 400 or so Palestinian athletes have been martyred. These athletes are from all kinds of sporting backgrounds, football, volleyball, handball, and individual sports like martial arts. All of these sports lost memorable players. More than 400 Palestinian martyrs sacrificed their lives for the cause of Palestine. The Palestinian athlete is a Palestinian citizen before he or she is an athlete.
Israel deliberately targeted the sports sector as it did other sectors, such as health, social, and economics. We in the sports sector have 400 martyrs.
At the top is Captain Ahed Zakout, who is one of our trainers. Many young players also were assassinated in the southern governorates. We as sports people are supposed to have immunity under international law to travel and participate, but Israel flouts these laws and international regulations.
On the morning of July 30, 2014, one Israeli war jet targeted a residential apartment with a rocket. The apartment was owned by the late athlete Ahed Zakout in the Al-Nasser neighborhood in Gaza City, bringing an end to the life of an athlete who continues to inspire many even after his death.
I woke up to the voice of my mother screaming my name and my father's name, Khaled and Ahed. I went out and answered, "Here I am." She asked me where my father was. I say, "I don't know. I will look for him." She ran out of the house screaming for someone to help. The living room was on fire. A missile had hit the house, smashing walls and room and setting the living room on fire. My uncle was the first to enter our house.
I turned around and came into the house. The bedroom door was broken, blocking the entrance. I kicked it with my leg and was surprised to see Ahed lying under the separating wall between the bedroom and the living room. He was still breathing. His son then entered and started screaming.
We told him to bear witness that there is no God, but Allah and Muhammad is his messenger. In his last moments, he was opening his mouth and closing it. Then the ambulance came and took him to the hospital, but he was later taken to the cemetery.
Captain Ahed Zakout was the star player of the Palestinian National Football League. He was the star of Gaza Sports Club and played in many clubs inside Palestine. Then he became a trainer after retiring as a football player. He focused on the youth. Captain Ahed Zakout wanted Palestine to have a promising future. He focused on having a national Palestinian team that would qualify for the finals of the World Cup in 10 years' time. But it seems this dream did not appeal to Israel. The Israeli occupation focuses on how to hit us at the core.
Despite all the crimes committed by the occupation against Palestinian sports and athletes, they would not be able to achieve their aims to undermine the resolve of the aspiring athletes who hope to represent Palestine at international tournaments and to hold high the Palestinian flag in states that have ignored and still ignore Palestinian rights.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
in the limelight.
Rapprochement seems to be the word of the day for many Arab countries regarding Syria. But many Arab countries cut off their ties with Syria back in 2013-2014, from Oman to Egypt to United Arab Emirates. And now Saudi Arabia is inviting Syria to rejoin the Arab League and to attend the next meeting of the Arab League, which will be held in Saudi Arabia itself. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of Middle East Eye has covered this story and tells us more. Saudi Arabia plans to invite Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to the Arab League summit in Riyadh on 19th of May. According to sources, the Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud is expected to visit Damascus early in the coming days to hand over an official invitation to the summit to President Bashar al-Assad. Syria's membership of the Arab League was suspended in November of 2011, following escalation of the foreign-backed militancy in that country. Failing to force the Syrian authorities into concessions in favor of the militants and terrorists, most of the Arab countries recalled their ambassadors from Damascus and joined the economic boycott of Syria. Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and several other Arab countries extended military and financial assistance to illegal armed groups fighting against the Syrian government during the conflict. In recent years, several Arab countries, including the United Arab Emirates, Oman, and Bahrain, resumed the work of their diplomatic missions in Damascus. But the issue of Syria's reinstatement as an Arab League member state still stirs up debates among the member nations. The Arab League, formerly known as the League of Arab States, was set up on 22nd of March 1945 in Cairo, Egypt, by seven Arab countries, namely Egypt, Iraq, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Transjordan, and Yemen. Now the organization has 22 member states. A diplomatic source in Beirut, Lebanon, told the TASS news agency on 20th of March that the Saudi foreign minister planned to visit Damascus, Syria, during the Eid al-Fitr holiday celebrated this year on 22nd of April, after the fasting month of Ramadan. The source also said that the visit would be a time to mark the opening of the Saudi embassy in Damascus after a 12-year hiatus. Reuters news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. Saudi Arabia and Syria have agreed to reopen their embassies after cutting diplomatic ties more than a decade ago when the foreign-sponsored Syrian conflict started. The Reuters news agency, citing a source with knowledge of the matter, reported recently that contacts between Riyadh and Damascus had gathered momentum following a landmark agreement earlier this month between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Saudi Arabia on restoration of bilateral relations after a seven-year break. A second regional source aligned with the Damascus government said the two governments were preparing to reopen embassies after the Eid al-Fitr, which marks the end of the holy fasting month of Ramadan. Another source noted that the decision was the result of talks in Saudi Arabia with a senior Syrian intelligence official. The sources spoke on condition of anonymity due to the sensitivity of the subject. The high-ranking Syrian intelligence official reportedly stayed for days in Riyadh, and an agreement was struck to reopen embassies very soon. One of the sources identified the official as Hossam Loura, who heads Syria's intelligence committee, asserting that the talks included security on Syria's border with Jordan and measures to combat smuggling of illegal amphetamine, Captagon pills, from terrorist-held areas in Syria to to the Persian Gulf Kingdom. Russia's Sputnik News Agency reported the reopening of the Saudi embassy in Damascus will be preceded by Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud's visit to Syria, during which he will meet with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Back in March of 2012, Saudi Arabia closed its embassy in Damascus and then severed diplomatic ties with the Syrian government. The sudden diplomatic breakthrough could indicate how the deal between Tehran and Riyadh may play into the settlement of other crises in the West Asia region. The website of Press TV has also covered this story and tells us more. A former British ambassador to Syria has said Saudi Arabia and Syria's attempt to mend fences is a slap in the face and a big setback for the United States, calling the rapprochement an important political achievement for Syria. Peter Ford, a former British ambassador to Syria, said on Sunday, 2nd of April, that the re-establishment of Damascus-Riyadh diplomatic ties shows that Syria has survived and is going from strength to strength regionally. Peter Ford said, above all, restoration of ties puts pressure on the United States, which is going to interpret this as a slap in the face, adding, this is a big setback for the Americans, for their regional diplomacy. Peter Ford explained that the resumption of relations between the kingdom and Syria is more of political importance rather than a military one. He added, it has been a long time now since most of the Persian Gulf countries stopped giving active support to the armed militants in Syria. Therefore, the rapprochement is not going to change what was already an improved situation on the ground, but it's very important politically. It demonstrates that Syria has survived and is going from strength to strength regionally. He also said that Riyadh's turn in strategy had occurred 3 years ago over the course of the 2019 Persian Gulf crisis and the increase of military tensions between Iran and the United States following the U.S. stepped-up efforts to stop Iranian tankers from taking oil through the Persian Gulf. Peter Ford added that the drone attack by Yemen's Ansarullah resistance forces on the facilities operated by Saudi Arabia's Aramco, the country's state-owned oil company, at about the same time in September, made the kingdom believe that they cannot rely on America's protection. Peter Ford said, the Saudis realized that they were on their own and that they were more likely to be dragged into the U.S. wars than have them defend Saudi Arabia. And what we have seen over the last 3 years has been the gradual elaboration of this tendency. He added, and they realized that they have to get along with the Islamic Republic of Iran. In March, Tehran and Riyadh signed a Chinese-brokered normalization agreement after several days of intensive negotiations in Beijing. Peter Ford also lauded Russia's extremely important role in restoring ties between Damascus and Riyadh. He added, this is what Russia does so well, serious diplomacy. In fact, Russia gave the Americans a masterclass on how to conduct West Asia diplomacy. He concluded by saying, and the Arab League summit with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad probably invited is going to be a crowning achievement. Since 2011, Syria has been gripped by foreign-backed militancy, leading to the emergence of Daesh terrorists and various other terrorist groups in the Arab country. Key Arab countries tried to oust President Assad during the conflict in Syria. In November of 2011, the Arab League suspended Syria's membership, citing an alleged crackdown by Damascus on opposition protests. Syria has denounced the move as illegal and a violation of the organization's charter.
Hidden Files. Have you heard about the billionaire space race? What about Harvey Weinstein's abuse case? Or the Trump supporters' takeover of the U.S. Capitol? Well, chances are that you have. When it comes to major stories from mainstream media, the world is certainly a small place where the news is heard loud and clear. But in the cacophony of these major stories, there are many voices that are hushed. Stories that seem as small as a single ordinary person and yet are as large as a community, a major city, or even a nation. Hello, and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and today in this program, I'd like to take a pledge to provide you with a rare glimpse of news that seldom make the news, or stories that don't fit the mainstream plot, and of voices that are silent. But before we go further, let me tell you a personal story that doesn't only belong to me, one in which, had things gone differently, I would likely not be here with you today, and neither, perhaps, with the idea of this program, a story that started some 3 years ago with my arrest in the U.S.
It's just past 7:30 in the morning over here in the Iranian capital. You're going to have to begin this bulletin with a shocking development. Press TV's news anchor, Marzia Hashimi, has been detained and imprisoned in the United States with no formal charges. Ms. Hashimi was arrested in a St. Louis airport and has now been transferred to a Washington, D.C. facility by the FBI. The reason for her arrest, as I just said, remains unclear up to this moment. She was visiting the United States to visit her ill brother, who was terminally ill, I've been hearing, and, of course, visiting her other relatives. Ms. Hashimi has informed her family members of her ill treatment in detention. Hashimi, a Muslim woman, was born in the United States and is an American citizen.
Such stories of being kidnapped and arrested without charge are so surreal that it's hard to believe that it can happen to you. Until, of course, it does. Growing up as a Black American, studying journalism as a student and later as a convert to Islam, I heard and read this happened to many others, of course, but I never thought that I myself could end up being kidnapped and arrested. And that's exactly the point. The numbers speak for themselves.
Mass incarceration in the United States definitely has a racial component to it. According to the United States Sentencing Commission, Black male offenders receive sentences on average 19.1% longer than similarly situated white male offenders. In addition, Black men are six times more likely to be incarcerated than white men. Following is the lifetime likelihood of imprisonment for U.S. residents born in 2001.
With me understanding well the history of policing and the judicial system in the United States, when I was arrested, I knew that anything could happen to me. I knew that there were political prisoners in the country who were still incarcerated after 40 years and had spent most of those years in solitary confinement. Though the United States denies having any political prisoners, I knew how people had been framed for so many offenses. Now, my case was quite unique in another aspect. That is, unlike the many black men, Muslims, and activists, I had a decent following as a media personality here at Press TV. So the station kicked off an awesome information campaign about what was happening, and social media groups went into full gear getting the word out. I didn't know about all this from the inside of prison, of course, but I did see that my treatment was quickly improved, and then in a matter of days, I was released without charge. But I don't know of anyone else who has been this blessed. It's not uncommon for black men, for Muslims, and for activists to spend years in prison, at times in solitary confinement, without there being a shred of honest evidence against them. Many end up pleading guilty as they are not told that they will not be released unless they plea bargain and spend some years in prison. So it's only fair for me to use this platform to speak about those whose cases haven't received this kind of public attention, like fellow Americans whose country claims to be the vanguard of protecting human rights around the world, when in actuality it often falls quite short of defending human rights even according to its own constitution. Well, I'd like to bring in my special guest for this program. Welcome, and Dr. Cynthia McKinney to Hidden Files.
Dr. Cynthia McKinney. As a member of the Democratic Party, Dr. McKinney served 6 terms in the U.S. House of Representatives starting from 1993. McKinney left the Democratic Party and ran in 2008 as the presidential candidate of the Green Party of the United States. She is a major critic of U.S. policy as it is related to Israel, and was part of a Gaza relief boat to help to get basic supplies to the Palestinian people of Gaza. The boat was attacked by the Israeli Navy. McKinney introduced legislation to have the government release information about the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. She has also introduced legislation demanding the release of government information regarding the murder of Tupac Shakur.
Thanks so much for being with us. It's a pleasure having you. Well, I'd like to start off in looking at the situation. I mean, it was amazing what happened to me and the way it went down, Cynthia. And it appears what we're seeing is the erosion of the Constitution. Your thoughts about this, and how exactly is this happening? What's going on?
Well, I think what has happened in the United States is that over the years, we've had a gradual shifting in even the kind of governance system that exists inside the United States. So there was a time when the Constitution was the primary law of the land, and people spoke about constitutionalism. The Bill of Rights was something that rolled off the tongues of everyone, and if a law or a particular behavior was unconstitutional, it was challenged. But gradually what happened is that we saw the erosion of not just, of constitutionalism and of the Bill of Rights itself. And so a situation like what happened to you, which is unconscionable in a country that prides itself on freedom and due process and justice, but now no one's rights are guaranteed. And so you've got people who went to the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, and they are in solitary confinement. Many of them have been in solitary confinement for months now. And the situation has changed. I believe what has happened is that there has been a coup against the U.S. Constitution. And the average, ordinary U.S. citizen doesn't realize that the constitutional protections that have been guaranteed for centuries really are no longer protecting the people of the United States. And the average ordinary U.S. citizen doesn't realize that the constitutional protections that have been guaranteed for centuries really are no longer protecting the people of the United States.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting what you said. I mean, your thoughts overall on the role of the mainstream media in misinforming people about that reality of constitutional law and the basic rights that Americans once had, but they no longer do.
We used to have media. Well, actually, there was a time when we had real media. And even though that media had its own sort of vested interest or special interest in and of itself, you could at least get half of the story from U.S. Media. It's Walter Cronkite, and that's the end of the story. Or you'd have the other fella on radio, and he'd say, and now the rest of the story. So there was always a way to dig a little bit deeper, and we had investigative journalists who were given the opportunity to do, to hone their craft with the problems around governance. So you even had, say, for example, the Washington Post with Watergate. You had, it was the Washington Post that broke the story. Right. Now the Washington Post covers up because it's been purchased sort of indirectly by the CIA by way of Jeff Bezos and a $600 million contract for various things that Bezos was able to get by way of Amazon. So you've got a situation now where we don't even have alternative, we don't have responsible corporate media, we don't have alternative media, because now the foundations have stepped in, and you've got George Soros who's pouring money into the Democratic Party, pouring money into alternative media. You've got already the other foundations, the Rockefeller Foundation and other foundations, pouring money into alternative media. So what used to be that, or what used to provide that critical analysis of what actually is happening in our political system and who is benefiting and who is losing, you don't have those questions even asked any longer. And so therefore, we've also had a situation where the courts in the United States have said that it's okay for the media to knowingly lie to its consuming audience. So now you've got legalized lying, you've got an end of investigative journalists, you've got the concentration of ownership of the media, both alternative and sort of corporate. And so now, basically, I think it was Mark Twain who said, even back then, he said that, you know, the more education you have, if you get your information from the regular media, then you're misinformed. Well, yeah, you're misinformed, and vast numbers of people in the United States are misinformed because they get their media from what they think are trusted sources, but they're no longer trusted.
What's your perspective on the internet being controlled and how that can affect people who are actually searching for the truth?
The shame of it all is that the internet itself and the research and development that gave us quote unquote social media was paid for by U.S. taxpayers. For these should be, as are the airwaves for that matter, should be public resources. But there's very little public in the public resources that have been privatized. Well, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said we need a revolution of values. And I would agree with that, talking about the United States. I would just say that we need a revolution, and that would probably end it full stop. We need to do away with everything that we know, because it took a turn. And the turn that it took has been to the detriment of the people. It has been to the detriment of truth. It has been to the detriment of justice. It has been to the detriment of peace. We haven't had peace since I was an adult. And now I'm entering my senior years, and we still don't have peace. And in large measure, it's because of the belligerent policies of the United States of America. So we need to build new institutions, and they can exist alongside the current ones, but eventually we've got to get rid of the current institutions that no longer work for the people and no longer represent what they are supposed to be.
Well, when we look at the situation, I mean, Cynthia, both of us are American and neither one of us are living in the United States because of various reasons now. But when we look at the situation, the increase of censorship and pressure as far as the taking away of being able to have freedom of speech, I mean, what's happening? Where are we going with this?
Unfortunately, and there are so many more who are laboring inside the United States in jobs that they don't like, jobs that don't respect them, jobs just in order to make ends meet. And they, you know, for example, you have, I guess I shouldn't name, but I have followed many of the professors who are inside the United States, and they've been punished because of their belief system. And one of them is a Palestinian American who had a job offered to him, and then the job was snatched away from him when he put something on Twitter. And it's a shame. We have another professor who wrote a very internationally acclaimed book. That book was about the Holocaust, and he told me, Cynthia, I haven't worked since then. And that's probably been about 10 years ago, 10 or maybe 15 years ago now. So people are being punished. People are suffering in their own ways because the diminution of rights and the Bill of Rights is not a document that is living and breathing in the United States any longer.
Where do you see all this going? I mean, what has to happen in your perspective?
Well, people outside sort of look at you askance when you say, well, you know, I'm much more comfortable outside of the U.S. than I am inside the U.S. And people don't like outside because the United States is something, it's a dream. It's something to be aspired to. To live inside the United States. Every child's goal in life in certain countries is to be able to get a job in the United States, to be culled by the great culling machine and then leave one's country in the brain drain and go and help make private organizations like Google and Facebook more wealthy than they already are. The world has been turned upside down. Our values have been turned upside down, and the system is rigged, and it's rigged internationally as well. That's not just a inside the United States kind of thing. It's been rigged for hundreds of years. How do we unrig ourselves? I was at an anti-war protest, and I ended my speech by saying, "We shall take our country back." And then I thought about it for a while, and I said, I've been participating in anti-war speeches for 20 years, and we still haven't taken our country back, and we haven't ended the wars. After that last anti-war speech with the anti-war crowd that I was with, those are my people, and I thought about it, and I said, you know, I've been protesting for 20 years. I've been saying we're going to take for 20 years, and it hasn't happened yet. So what's the missing ingredient? When Trump said that the system is rigged, it was right. It was accurate. It was an accurate statement of that people in the U.S. find with their